case on this docket. It's Marquez versus Schwartz. Are the council present? All right, as council may know, each party has 15 minutes aside. We have a lighting system on the podium. The light will turn to yellow when you have 5 minutes remaining, and the appellant may request time for rebuttal. Please stay at the podium and state your name and your registration number when you come to the podium. The proceedings are being recorded, and also the proceedings will be on the internet, so if there's any sensitive information, you may want to keep that in mind while you're talking today. Also, we have read the briefs and we are familiar with the facts, so you may want to adjust your argument accordingly. And finally, if anyone in here has any cell phones, you may want to turn that off so as not to interrupt the argument. All right, and when the appellant is ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Brian Johnson, registration number 36335, counsel. Your Honors, I would like to take the first 10 minutes for arguments and reserve the last 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case is a medical malpractice case, which got to a motion to dismiss on behalf of the filed by the defendant. And I think it's important in this case to kind of keep your eye on the ball, because the trial court dismissed this case with some reasoning. And the trial court kind of went beyond, I think, kind of went beyond the reasoning for jurisdiction of why it was dismissed, and almost tried the whole case based on a motion to dismiss. And the appellants, or the plaintiffs in this case, judges, they just want the opportunity to get this case back in front of the trial court and to present some evidence as to why there would be jurisdiction for this case to go forward. And there are three doctors involved in this case. One is Dr. Parker, one is Dr. Miyamoto, and one is Dr. Schwartz. Briefly, my clients, the plaintiffs, got pregnant in the spring of 2005 and she saw her general obstetrician during her pregnancy. Because her age was a little more advanced, she was referred to Dr. Schwartz, who's a perinatologist working from Porter Hospital. So he saw her during the course of her pregnancy, and at one point performed an ultrasound, in which we later found out, he noted in his notes, that the child had a normal four-chambered heart. She delivered early at the end of August, and her little baby boy Kyle was born. And within 2 days, it was discovered that he had hypoplastic left heart syndrome, which is an underdevelopment of the left ventricle of the heart. Because it wasn't diagnosed in utero, it wasn't known immediately when Kyle was born, so he languished basically for 2 days, unable for his body to pump oxygenated blood back through his body. When they determined that after the second day, they transferred him to the Children's Hospital, because obviously they're specialized there in treating infants. Kyle was taken there. By that time, obviously some damage had been done. They tried to maintain him and finally put him on a heart transplant list, but upon the ninth day of his life, Kyle expired. So the court, this case has to do right now, it's been dismissed because the court found it didn't have jurisdiction under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. And the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act requires a notice within, written notice within 180 days to the agency, notifying with the claim and the facts and the amounts. And the court found the standard in Colorado when the court reviews jurisdiction, whether or not a defendant is entitled to protection or limited immunity under the CGIA, is whether or not, first of all, the plaintiff had notice of their, or when they discovered their injury, could start the time. But jurisdiction also depends upon whether or not the plaintiff had actual or constructive notice, and that's a case of Racevich, which is I cite in my brief, where it talks about that the plaintiff should at least have actual or constructive notice. The law is a little, well, the CGIA, let's say, it covers a very wide scope of situations. Obviously, when we're talking about governmental immunity or governmental entities in the state of Colorado, there are all kinds. And medical malpractice cases, not only in non-governmental cases, but particularly in governmental cases, are unique in that plaintiffs oftentimes don't even know if they've been injured immediately. It's not like being hit by a state maintenance truck while you're sitting on the highway. And I just want to point out some unique facts in this case in that, first of all these doctors, none of these doctors were working at a per se governmental hospital. So when these folks walk into the hospital, you have no obvious notice that you're going, that it's not at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. This was at the perinatology services took place at Porter, and the treatment of Kyle took place at the Children's Hospital.
Mr. Johnson, what about Trinity and Shandy v. Lunsford would seem to suggest that once somebody is aware of an injury, that within that 180-day period, that person has an obligation to determine whether the alleged tortfeasor was a government employee.
And that's a key question, Your Honor. And so the question becomes, when did they discover the injury? And
well, but I'm focusing just on the question of when did they know that Dr. Schwartz and the other two doctors were public employees. So are you agreeing then that by going on to the next step that they had an obligation to determine whether Dr. Schwartz and the other two doctors were governmental employees within 180 days of whenever they realized that there was an accident or alleged negligence?
Well, first of all, I don't agree, and I submit that in my brief, that upon Kyle's death did not trigger, it says wrongful injury. It says wrongful injuries. And at that point, these folks didn't know it was a wrongful injury yet. They knew their child had been born with a defect and he died. And it wasn't until much later were they able to determine that it was a wrongful injury. And in fact, that didn't even come until the records were reviewed by a doctor later on, because, Your Honor, when you're standing on the side of the road and a state salt truck comes by and runs over you, it's pretty obvious you've been injured. You know you've been injured, and you saw a sign on the side of the truck that hit you. But in a case like this, that's not the case. And specifically, when these folks came to me and I took this case, they had no idea at the time that any of those doctors were employees of the University of Colorado. Even up to that point, which was in the spring of 2007. And they came to me, and they had no idea. And in fact, I tried to track down who the doctors worked for.
Mr. Johnson, I have one question. Are you arguing then that the 180 days is not triggered until they know that there were public employees who allegedly engage in wrongful conduct?
Yeah, I think, Judge, if you get the cart before the horse, unless you know that they're government employees, then and unless you have actual or constructive notice that they're government employees, the 180-day requirement doesn't even trigger. You have to know that. If you don't know that, how can you follow a 180-day requirement if you don't even know that you're dealing with a government employee?
Was there a written notification somewhere that indicated that some of the employees may be governmental employees?
Judge,
is that sufficient?
The only place that was present was in some admission documents from Children's Hospital, where it says in one of the forms, many employees or many healthcare providers at TCH, and there's some specific wording, but are employees of the University of Colorado. And that's the only thing. It says many employees. Now, to the average person that comes in there that signs a bunch of documents, I'm not arguing that there wasn't some language in there, but when you impose such a strict requirement of the Governmental Immunity Act on a common citizen, and I get dozens of people that have called me in my practice of medical malpractice and say, well, I went to Denver Health like 18 months ago and I stopped them, and I go, these folks have no idea that Governmental Immunity Act applies to doctors and hospitals. So if you're going to apply such a strict standard to these folks and require them to do this notice within 180 days, it should at least be somewhere in black and white and expressly in front of them that saying, hey, you're being treated, or Dr. Parker or Dr. Miyamoto is an employee of the University of Colorado and as such has limited immunities under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. And you are required to, if you're going to hold someone to the feet to the fire like that, then you at least need to make sure they understand what they're getting themselves into. And I have this very sneaking suspicion that these administrators like to put this in this notice with all these papers that are filed and then come back later and go, ah, look, see, it says right here, many employees. Well, who? The janitors, the nurses,
Counselor,
the lab technicians?
Do they have any obligation to put any written notice in there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do they have any obligation to put any written notice in there at all?
Your Honor, here's the quandary we ran into. I didn't find out Dr. Schwartz was an employee of the University of Colorado until after I served him. They told me that he was under contract with Porter. I actually, in trying to figure out how to serve Dr. Schwartz, I called Parker Hospital and asked their HR department if they could tell me, because I wonder if he was a member of a practice group, because I was going to serve the practice group. They told me, even Parker told me, he was independent. When they credentialed him, he was independent. He had an office at Porter. Now, he signed an affidavit, and which was they attached as an exhibit to their supplemental memorandum as Exhibit D1, and an affidavit that says Dr. Schwartz told them that he, you know, came in and he said, by the way, I'm an employee of the University of Colorado. In my 48 years of life experience and all the hospitals and doctors I've been to with myself and my children, I have never had a doctor walk into me and tell me who he worked for. And my clients absolutely dispute that. And the point is, Judge, that they never got a chance to go into court to the judge and swear in, sit on the stand and say, Your Honor, that's not true. I don't care what he said in his affidavit. That's just not true.
But my question, to back up for just a second, is under the current Colorado Governmental Immunity Act case law, did they have any obligation to reveal that he was a government employee? It says in the document, I think you said, that many employees were.
That's correct.
If they had left it out completely under the current law, did they have any obligation to even to reveal anything about that?
I absolutely think they do, yes. And there's case law on that, Judge, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of going a mile a minute, but I know there's case law, whether it's Racevich, and it escapes me now, but they Racevich does say they have to have actual or constructive notice. And I suppose constructive notice would be if you walk into the University of Colorado and you get treated by someone, you pretty much have constructive notice. But when the University of Colorado salts the hospitals around town with university physicians, and then the physicians sign their name to an affidavit saying, yeah, I came in and told you that. Well, if that's the case, then I think the trial court should have given us an opportunity to go out and interview, to do some discovery and find out who Dr. Schwartz's patients were and find out, did he tell them that? Did he tell everybody that? Because I have a very sneaking suspicion that he did not. Now, the other thing they submit as an exhibit is a copy for constructive notice is a copy of billing records from university physicians. And it's at on their motion to dismiss, exhibit D1, they have copies of billing records showing that the Marquez's got billing records from University of Physicians, so they had constructive notice. If you look carefully, those billing notices were generated after the lawsuit was filed for services that took place in 2005. But there's no proof that they ever received those things. They generated those in October of 2007, a month after we filed the lawsuit. And then and there's also argument that we never gave notice. Even when we found out, we never gave notice, even if it was in the summer of 2007. And they say that, and the defense has said, that if we, the Governmental Immunity Act allows for a stay of the statute of limitations until they answer. We didn't even know at that time that they were governmental employees. And even had I known, because there's some issues of whether or not they really had notice and whether the CJI applies to them, I couldn't have not filed suit because I would have taken the chance of letting the statute of limitations run out if it was later found out that, in fact, they weren't provided with protection of the CJIA.
Mr. Johnson, one of the things I was wondering is that apparently there's never been any notice of claim filed in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's exactly why. We didn't know Dr. Schwartz was a member. We didn't know any of them were university employees until after we filed the lawsuit.
No, I understand that, but apparently today you would agree that the defendants are all or were state employees at the time.
Actually,
is that correct?
Excuse me. Actually, Your Honor, if you look at the exhibit for Dr. Parker, his contract expired 2 months before the birth of the child. Okay, there's actually absolutely been no evidence presented by the defense that Dr. Parker was under contract with the hospital, with the university.
Okay, what about with regard to the other two doctors? You're apparently conceding that they were state employees at the time.
All I know is that Dr. Miyamoto, from what I can see, had a valid contract at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Parker, his contract had expired at that time when Kyle was born. And Dr. Schwartz, his contract started in June of 2005 or four, and was to go year to year. And there's really no concrete evidence that he was still under that contract and wasn't independent, because it was only for a year. Now, he says in his affidavit that he was, and the billing records show that university physicians were billing as of the time that he was providing the services. But and so I guess now, looking back, and after somebody provides me the paperwork now, yes. But at the time,
well, I guess my question is this: I'm not aware of any other situation where, because of uncertainty about whether somebody was a governmental employee, that a lawsuit proceeded where no notice of claim was filed whatsoever. Are you?
No, I'm not. As an issue of first impression, as far as I'm concerned, Your Honor. And here's the other interesting thing, is that if
counsel, the fact... I'm sorry, your time is up.
Now, so much for my 5 minutes, like rebuttal, I guess. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Moran. My registration number is 16119, and I represent the defendants appellees, Dr. Joel Schwartz, Dr. Thomas Parker, and Dr. Shelley Miyamoto. Filing a timely notice of claim under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act is jurisdictional. It was undisputed, at least by way of everything that was filed in the trial court, that these doctors were all public employees at the time they provided treatment to Kyle Marquez. Some new arguments have been brought up on appeal, and I'd like to just mention those. The first is that Dr. Parker's contract had allegedly expired at the time he had treated Kyle. His contract was attached to the motion to dismiss. It was his initial contract. No argument was made by the plaintiffs that any of these doctors were not public employees. The response essentially conceded that they were public employees and simply argued that the plaintiffs did not know their public employee status. At no time did the plaintiff ever raise the issue that Dr. Parker was no longer a member of the faculty of the School of Medicine. Had that been raised, it could have been responded to at that time, because these contracts are renewed year by year.
Ms. Moran, was Dr. Parker's contract for a fixed term?
It was what is called a limited appointment that is year by year, subject to renewal at the end of each year.
Then how would anybody know whether the contract that was attached to the motion to dismiss had been renewed?
No question was ever raised by the plaintiff that it had not been renewed.
But I understand that you said that, but on the other hand, is there a presumption, some kind of legal presumption, that a contract that's subject to renewal is automatically renewed?
I don't believe there's any such presumption, Your Honor. Had we had the opportunity to address it, had it been brought up, my understanding is that initial contract is signed and then renewed from year to year, and in fact has been in this case. But the point of bringing up something before the trial court is not only to let the trial court consider it, but to allow the other side to respond to it.
I guess my question goes, though, to the evidence being presented on behalf of Dr. Parker to establish whether or not he was a governmental employee at the time it issued. Isn't part of presenting a prima facie case presenting information that would show that he was still an employee, a state employee, at the time of at issue here, either through an affidavit or through a copy of a renewal contract for the applicable time?
I I agree that a prima facie case would be to show that he was a public employee at the time. I'm not sure why that particular contract was attached. And so all I can say is, had the issue been raised, it would have been responded to. No such issue certainly was raised at all with respect to Dr. Schwartz or Dr. Miyamoto. Plaintiff did not file a notice at any time, even after filing the lawsuit in this case. And the trial court here held, after considering the Rule 12B1 motions, ruled as fact finder that plaintiffs discovered or reasonably should have discovered their injury no later than approximately December of 2006. And in so doing, the court essentially accepted all of the plaintiff's arguments as to the sequence of events following Kyle's birth. And what the plaintiffs had argued was that, first of all, during Mrs. Marquez's pregnancy, that they were informed by Dr. Schwartz that the ultrasound showed a normal four-chambered heart. After Kyle was born, within 2 days, the Marquez's learned that he did not have a normal four-chambered heart, that he in fact had hypoplastic left heart syndrome. They went through, understandably, a period of grieving, and then, as set forth in the plaintiff's own opening brief, began to question how Dr. Schwartz could tell them he had a normal four-chambered heart when in fact he did not. And in their opening brief, by their own admission, they say they were led to believe that the hypoplastic left heart syndrome could have been diagnosed in utero and that steps could have been taken to manage the condition such that his death would not have resulted.
Counsel, what's the statute of limitations typically for a medical malpractice case like this?
For a death case, it is 2 years, and it's in wrongful death, it runs from the time of death.
So some of the questions that I asked your counterpart then dealt with the notice requirement of a public employee, whether there is a requirement that the government employee advise or notify the parties that you don't have a 2-year statute of limitation, you actually have 180 days, and I am a government employee. Is there any such requirement like that?
I'm not aware of any such requirement, Your Honor, either in the statute or in any case. The Plum Creek versus Racevich case, I think, is an incorrect statement of the law. That case came out of the federal district court just a matter of weeks after the Trinity Broadcasting case was decided. And Trinity clearly says that when you discover your injury is when the time starts running, then the burden is on the plaintiff to discover what's the cause, are there public employees involved, and to get that notice filed within 180 days. The court in Racevich applied an equitable tolling theory, which the Colorado Supreme Court has subsequently rejected as being inapplicable to the 180-day notice period.
So to follow up on my question that I asked your counterpart then, was there any obligation to say anything in writing about whether some or many or all or this particular doctor was a state governmental employee?
Not under the Governmental Immunity Act. I'm aware of no requirement for that.
So as I understand the law, Ms. Moran, if somebody recognizes that there has been an injury, then that person is, as of that date, has 180 days to file a notice of claim, even if that person cannot determine within that 180-day period whether the potential defendant is a governmental employee. Is that correct?
I believe so, Your Honor. That the discovery of the injury, and that's been defined as a wrongful injury, and its discovery in the sense of either discover or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have discovered, that triggers the time for finding out who is involved, whether there are governmental entities involved, and to affect the filing of notice at that point.
So as a practical matter, if plaintiff's attorneys regularly filed notices of claim in any potential medical malpractice case, would there be any response to the notice of claim? And if so, would it indicate whether or not the doctor was or was not a governmental employee?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I guess maybe I need to ask for clarification. Is if the plaintiff's attorney files a notice with a governmental entity, would they receive a response back saying yes or no that doctor is or is not
yes,
a governmental
that's what I'm
employee? I assume that they would because the government has some response obligations. I don't know that in practice how that works,
okay.
Whether that happens all the time, most of the time, or some of the time. So, moving on, plaintiffs recognized their injury when they were led to believe that the defect should have been diagnosed in utero and managed differently. At that point, they requested the medical records, received some of the medical records, including imaging studies from Dr. Schwartz, and then for a period of months, we don't know what happened. They hired an attorney, 8 months passed, and then they filed suit. As the trial courts recognized, at the point where plaintiffs believed they had been injured and requested the records is when the notice period began to run. At that point, it was their obligation to determine who was involved, to determine who employed Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Parker, and Dr. Miyamoto, if that was relevant, and to file a notice if a notice was required. That was not done.
Do you agree that that point in time was the point that triggered the 180 days, is when they believed something was wrong?
That, I think what the trial court ruled was that as soon as they got the records, they had everything in their hands that they needed in order to determine who to sue and whether notice was required. I think actually really discovered the injury came, as it basically admitted in their opening brief, is when they were led to believe that this should have been diagnosed earlier. This all, according to the plaintiff's argument, this all took place in a period of time somewhere around November to December of 2006. And so what the trial court determined was, at that point, once they had that belief coupled with getting records, that is when the notice period began. I'd like to talk briefly about the argument that it's necessary to be constructively or actually aware that the defendants are public employees. Again, there's no requirement for that under Colorado law. That argument has been specifically rejected in the Shandy versus Lunsford case. And citing Trinity, the panel of the court in that case said that the notice period is triggered by the discovery of the injury, and it's not postponed until the plaintiff also knows that the tortfeasor is a public entity or a public employee. So that argument has been made before, and it's been rejected. I'd like to address just a couple of points that the plaintiffs have made in their brief and also hear about the court not holding a hearing, and now here the issue has been brought up about the court not allowing any discovery. Well, discovery was never requested by the plaintiff, simply filed a response to the motion to dismiss and nothing more. The plaintiff did not request a hearing. Now, while the trial court is required to hold a hearing if there are disputed issues of fact, there were no disputed issues of fact here to hold a hearing on. There, as far as disputed facts about whether the plaintiffs knew these doctors were public employees, those are irrelevant because knowledge of their public employee status is irrelevant to when the notice period begins to run. On the issue of discovery of their injury, there were no disputed facts, at least in the way that the court addressed them in its order, because it accepted the plaintiff's sequence of events as true in ruling and making the determination that their discovery of injury occurred no later than approximately December of 2006. So for these reasons, unless the court has any further questions, I would simply ask that the court affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.
The court will be in recess, subject to call.